My name is Barb McCulley. I grew up and still presently live on a street called Conroy. When I was a kid, Crosley Field was so close, so you would walk to Crosley Field. We'd go down across McMicken, down across Central Parkway, go down to which is the old Coleraine Avenue, and then turn left on the Spring Road, walk up a little bit, and there it was, right there. It was really cool to be young and living around the stadium at that time. Even though at the time we never had a whole lot of money, but my dad always got seats behind third base. And at that time, Crosley Field, if you sat behind third base, it was like you could almost reach out and touch these guys. You were just so close to everything. Everything was there. And then off toward the right is where the Reds came out of their dugout. And the one day we went, and there was my brother Donnie, my father, and myself, and we had our programs. So we're by the third base. And the guys are going to come out. So my brother Donnie says, let's go over and get our program signed. We go over there and stand there. Well, I had natural curly hair. I look like Shirley Temple. But I was kind of quiet. So we're standing there. My brother Donnie reaches out. And here comes Kluszewski. And he gets his program signed. So then I'm standing there. And he says, what about you? And I just shook my head. I was like scared to death. My brother said, she's a little shy. She wants hers signed too. So he took it from me, signed it, and he rubbed the top of my head and goes, there you go, curly top. And it was like, wow, Ted Kluszewski signed this and he touched me. It was really cool. And I just remember he had these huge arms. He was this big guy into a little kid. He actually looked bigger than life. He had his sleeves out and he was just this gigantic person. But I thought it was really cool how he'd sign your autograph. And at that time, going to the stadium was so different than today. I mean, you were right there with the players, and you'd see Veda Pinson, Kluszewski, and Gus Bell, and Roy McMillan, and all these guys. It was just a different time. It just seemed like you were actually going there to see the game, not to see how many beers you could drink or whatever. It was just a great time. And I remember another thing that, well, as kids, we'd have baseball cards. I was a little bit of a tomboy, so you always wanted to get the big guys. Well, the one day I got Ted Kluszewski, and we used to flip baseball cards. And you never really wanted to throw out your good card because you could lose it. But every now and then, we'd be flipping baseball cards, and out came my Ted Kluszewski, and he leaned up against the wall. I won all the cards. And it wasn't I did it. It was my Ted Kluszewski card. It was very interesting and a lot of fun. And it was just a lot of good times going down to the old Crosley Field. I kind of miss that. It's totally different than today. It just, the whole atmosphere is different. It's good times today, but it's not that closeness. And they were always willing to sign something, your hat, your hand, whatever you put out there. So it was a very good time.
Chris Eckes, chief curator of the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum, recently took Mark Haney on a tour and pointed out some of the Ted Kluszewski memorabilia on display.
This uniform was the uniform that Ted Kluszewski wore. It was a home uniform during the famous 1956 season. In the pantheon of popular Reds teams, the 56 guys are right up there. They didn't win a pennant. They were right in the hunt until the final weekend of the season. But this was the group of power hitters, the Western Avenue Bombers. This was Clue and Wally Post and Frank Robinson as a rookie and Ed Bailey and these great home run hitters, and their home run hitting exploits really captured the fascination of the country. They wound up tying the all-time record for home runs hit by a team with 221 in 1956. And Ted Kluszewski, of course, was the first baseman. The example you see here is the vest-style uniform that Ted had a big part in convincing the Reds to adopt. If you've ever seen a photograph of Ted, Ted was a very big guy. And the uniform styles at the time didn't lend themselves to a lot of flexibility. But the real heavy flannel style uniforms, that you're playing baseball in Cincinnati in July, it is hot. And these things would just hold sweat. And the more they held sweat, the more constricting they became. Clue was not a guy who did well with being constricted in his swing. So what he started doing was taking it upon himself to cut his sleeve shorter and shorter so he would have more room when he swung the bat and threw the ball and so forth. And eventually, the higher his cuts got, the more it began to resemble a vest. And the Reds wound up adopting a vest-style uniform that became something of a trademark of theirs throughout that decade and symbolized no better than in the form of Clue. The photograph that you see behind the jersey is a great one from spring training. Ted's got a wheelbarrow full of bats that he's pushing along in front of the dugout, and you can see how his sleeves have been unnaturally abbreviated by him. So that's a pre-vest style jersey that Ted's wearing there. And then over on this side, we have a small display in place paying homage to Crosley Field, which is celebrating this is the 100th anniversary of Crosley's opening back in 1912. And you have that number 18 jersey there that actually was worn by Clue when he was inducted into the Reds Hall of Fame. The guys used to put on uniforms or old uniform styles during the induction ceremonies, and this is one that's been in the Reds collection ever since that Hall of Fame induction night. So that's a vest-style uniform that Ted wore very briefly, but he wore it during those induction ceremonies. The Reds used to do a publication called Red Leg News. It was something produced internally by the club, and it was basically just like a little newsletter or flyer. We have one on display here from 1953 that highlights Clue and his All-Star selection in 1953, and it's also highlighting Gus Bell, who was another member of that great 56 Reds team. Very gifted defensive outfielder and a very gifted hitter as well, who had pop, as seemingly everybody did, on that 1956 club. But yeah, that was a real neat publication. It went under different titles at different times, News of the Reds, among others. That was something that you could pick up to keep abreast of the current club, as well as they had a lot of minor league coverage in these publications as well.
Now, there's an overlap between Pete Rose and Ted Kluszewski. I mean, they were teammates together, and eventually he would have been the hitting coach?
No, Clue actually departed before Pete came along. Pete didn't come along in Cincinnati until 1963, and by that time, Ted had retired as a player. He was the hitting coach for Pete, yeah, so it kind of came full circle. I mean, obviously, he was the hitting coach throughout the decade of the 70s when Pete was a big part of the Big Red Machine, of course, up until 1978. And then when Pete came back as a manager in 1984, Ted was on his coaching staff during that period as well, up until the time of his death. Ted also went on to play for the Chicago White Sox. In 1959, the White Sox made the World Series. They were called the Go-Go Sox. They were known for their speed. They lost to the Dodgers in that World Series, but in something of a last hurrah for Ted as a great power hitter, he had 3 home runs in that World Series. So White Sox fans remember Ted well also for his exploits in that series, albeit for a losing effort. And it was the only World Series that Ted appeared in during his career. Many Reds fans will remember well Wade Hoyt, a favored broadcaster for many, many years. Hoyt was also an amateur painter, and he tended not to focus too much on painting people. He did a self-portrait where he's depicting himself on the mound as a Yankee, and of course he's in the Hall of Fame for his pitching achievements for the Yankees primarily. But he also did a portrait of Ted Kluszewski. And again, Wade was an amateur painter, but this particular painting, which is signed by Hoyt and was presented to the Kluszewski family, he really emphasizes Clue's chest and his arms, and it's like he's sort of bursting from the canvas. So he kind of captured the essence of Ted. Ted was a very big guy, but the great part about it was he was the epitome of the gentle giant. Ted was this big, hulking guy, but he was always the peacemaker. He was the one that wasn't going to start trouble, even though if he started it, he could also finish it very well, but he wasn't that way. He was a very competitive guy, and obviously that competitiveness translated into great success on the field, but everything I've ever read and every person I've ever talked to is that he was one of the sweetest men you'd ever want to meet. And you know, we're talking about his role as the hitting coach on the Big Red Machine. George Foster credits Ted with a great deal of his success, and it was Ted's record that George broke in 1977. Ted had held the record for most home runs by a Red in a single season with 49. So, very impressive number. In 1977, Foster hits 52, and that was his MVP season, and he remains the only Red to hit 50 or more home runs in a season. But no coincidence that his hitting coach at the time was Ted Kluszewski. So Ted helped George a lot in becoming the great power hitter that he was.
I meant to ask you about Kluszewski's bat. Mm-hmm. Now, he was swinging a heavier bat than most players.
Yeah, he was. And we've got an example of the bat back here. The other thing that's so remarkable about Ted Kluszewski is, for someone who was known as a home run hitter, justifiably so, he had tremendous, tremendous control of the strike zone. If you look at Ted's stats year in and year out, more often than not, at the height of his career for sure, he's hitting more home runs than he's striking out, which is just incredible to think of. These days, a guy hits 45 home runs and strikes out 100 times, we almost take it for granted because of the kind of hitters the approaches that they have at the plate lend themselves more to strikeouts. In Ted's time, strikeouts were looked on very unfavorably, and Ted did not strike out a lot. So to be able to hit almost 50 home runs and you're striking out less than 40 times in the same year that you hit 49 home runs, it's just incredible. So while Ted did have that kind of power, he also had great control at the plate. He could hit for average, which he did, and he got on base. He was not afraid to take what the pitcher gave him. He wasn't always up at the plate swinging for the fences. So it's another facet of his game that made him such a remarkable hitter. And what we're looking at here is a little tribute to that 1956 Reds club. We mentioned Gus Bell and Wally Post and Frank Robinson and, of course, Bertie Tebbets, the manager of that club. But the focal point is, again, Ted, because he was the most popular player on what became the most popular team in Reds history in many ways, and the team that really came to symbolize the 1950s. They gave each guy on that club a special ring. They call them the 221 rings, and those are the rings that represented the record-setting home run total that the club had hit that year. The bat that we have on display is one of Ted's models. It's actually from later in his career after he left the Reds, but it's a U1 style, so it doesn't have the really tightly defined knob. It's more of a smooth finish on the knob. And it was slightly heavier than what other players might use, but it wasn't as exaggerated as, say, Ed Rausch's bat, which is known as the heaviest bat ever wielded by anybody in baseball history. But that's one of my favorite things when talking about Ted Kluszewski is, for a power hitter, you look at some of his other statistics and you're really taken aback by how much he didn't do some things that you associate with power hitters. If there was any deficiency to his game at all, it might be that he wasn't terribly fleet of foot, but that's understandable. There he is right there. Ted Kluszewski, he was inducted in 1962, August 1st, to be specific. The Reds Hall of Fame, of course, began in 58, so he was part of one of the first induction classes. And deservedly, Hall of Fame can be interpreted as being the place for players who put great statistics together, but also you can take it literally, players who are famous. Ted Kluszewski, one of the most famous Reds in the history of the organization, and sort of a given that he would be inducted into the Reds Hall of Fame.
Good guy in the community as well.
Oh, yeah, but Ted was one of those guys that never said no to an autograph. He had a steakhouse here in Cincinnati, and it was not unusual to see him there greeting patrons as they walked into Ted Kluszewski's steakhouse. One of those guys, really, that just had a personality that was as big as he was. And that's a big part of the reason why fans loved him so much, because so many of them had that personal interaction with him, just like Joe. You'd run into Joe anywhere, and he would say hi. He'd talk to you. Ted was the same way. So, yeah, definitely an asset in that regard to the community and the organization as a whole.
I'm Howard Wilkinson, the politics writer for WVXU. And for many, many years, I've been going to spring training, Cincinnati Reds and Tampa and Plant City and Sarasota and even Goodyear. But the very first time I went was in 1982. And Ted Kluszewski was not on the coaching staff at that time, but he was a special instructor in hitting. And one of the things I always do at spring training is go early in the morning to the training fields. And in this case, it was at Tampa at Al Lopez Field, where they had a little old ballpark and some training fields for the major leaguers and the minor leaguers. And the first morning I was out there, Ted was standing by a batting cage, working with some minor league players on hitting. And they were using one of those old-fashioned pitching machines that had the tube, where it shot out of the tube instead of the sling that you see more often these days. And there was something wrong with the tube. The tube kept shooting balls to right-handed hitters way outside where they couldn't get at them. It was shooting pitches way inside on left-handed hitters where it was basically knocking them down. And Ted was getting frustrated with the machine. He says, oh, there's something wrong with this thing. So he looks over and he sees me standing there. And he says, hey, buddy, come here, help me out. So I walk over and I say, yes, sir, what can I do for you? He says, hold this machine down for me. And so I get down on my hands and knees and I'm holding this thing in place. And I'm looking up at him. And he grabs a hold of the tube. And I can see these big, huge arms twisting that tube and actually twisting the metal back into position. And he's grunting and groaning, but the thing is actually moving. And he gets it back into position. And he says, ah, there you go. Got it. And he started firing pitches, and pitches were going straight as an arrow. And it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And Ted just looks at me and said, "Hey, thanks, buddy. Thanks for your help." And I said, "Yes, sir, anytime." And that was my encounter with Ted Kluszewski.
When you first walk into the Reds Hall of Fame, you'll see their Big Red Machine exhibit, which is on display through the end of the year. Chris Eckes spoke with Mark Haney about some of the highlights.
We sort of bookend the beginning and end of the Big Red Machine with Pete's debut in 1963 and then Johnny Bench's retirement in 1983. There were a couple of guys, obviously, you know, Dave Concepcion carried on a little beyond that point, but when you think of the Big Red Machine, Bench and Rose many times are the two names you come up with first. And obviously, one of the great shots in Pete's career, that big grin on his face, he's bursting out of the dugout opening day 1963. It's a wonderful shot. And then down at the end of the timeline is Johnny on Johnny Bench night, where he's being honored for his wonderful career as a Red. And then along the way, a lot of the very familiar names and moments are highlighted. And of course, Bob Housen, the architect of the Big Red Machine, is a big part of this exhibit as well. Above you, we've got the banners, the actual banners that flew above Riverfront Stadium. Each banner represents one of the Reds' titles won in that decade. So you've got the two World Championship banners on either side of the room. They won pennants in 1972 and 1970, but fell in the World Series. And then 2 years where they won the division title, but came up short in the playoffs, 1973 and again in 1979. A lot of folks look at 1976 as the end date for the Big Red Machine. But truthfully, the majority of that club stayed intact, certainly through 78. Now, 78 marked Pete's last year as a Red. Sparky Anderson was let go as manager after that season. But if you look at that 1979 club that won the division, you still had Foster, Griffey, Bench, Morgan. So the Big Red Machine was still very much a part of that division-winning season in 79. So we really like to think of them as the team of the decade. They won more games than any other team in baseball throughout the decade of the 70s, and to sort of truncate it with Perez's departure seems a little unfair to the guys who were still part of those clubs that continued on after he left in the 70s. But yeah, moving along, I just want to, again, make reference to the banners. This is the first time that all six of the title banners from the decade of the 70s have been on display in one place at the same time. The tradition would be that you win the pennant in 1970, that flag flew over Riverfront throughout the 1971 season, and then, of course, came down at the end of the year. So these guys weren't really out that much. We've had a couple of them on display over the years in different exhibits that we've done, but to have them all together in one place is pretty special. But as we move along down here, talking about Bob Housen, really the brain trust behind the Big Red Machine. People think of the Big Red Machine, they think of the Great Eight and the players, but again, none of that happens without an extremely capable general manager who made a wonderful call in selecting the then-unknown Sparky Anderson to be his manager. And then, of course, Sparky did a wonderful job of picking a coaching staff. And one of his great selections was Ted Kluszewski, of course. And the jacket that you see here in the display case was Big Clue's warm-up jacket during his days as a coach in the early 70s. Ted had been kind of a spring training coach, advisor, done things like that for the club, but as an official member of the coaching staff, that began under Sparky. And of course, he lasted beyond Sparky as well. But this little display highlights that group and also pays homage to Ray Shore, who really kind of pioneered this idea of advanced scouting, which is very familiar to baseball operations today. But Ray would go out and scout the teams that the Reds were about to play, particularly when it came to his scouting acumen in the postseason. Sparky was always giving him credit for the Reds' success in the postseason, that they knew their opponents so well, and Ray's reports had a lot to do with that. So again, when a team does well, it's an entire organization that's working really at its best. Continuing to look around the exhibit, the North Wall does pay homage to what many consider the greatest lineup in baseball history, the famous Great Eight. And we have game-used jerseys, caps, and bats from each member of that Great Eight lineup in the order in which that lineup appeared prior to Game 7 of the 1975 World Series, which is the big graphic that you see above you. So, again, very special group. Some amazing stats when you look at this group. A lot of people think that the Big Red Machine, these guys at Grade 8, played together all the time. Sparky just wrote the same names in the lineup card every game and just let them go. It's really not true at all. The Grade 8's lifespan was pretty short. It didn't come about until May of 1975 when Pete Rose was shifted to third base at Sparky's request. That opened up a starting spot for George Foster in left field. And that group came together for the first time then. And it played its last game together in Game 4 of the 1976 World Series. So you really only had those two brief windows of time when they played together. In the postseason, that was the lineup that you saw. In fact, in the 1976 World Series, there was no other position player that had even a single appearance in a single game. It was those eight guys, every inning, every pitch, every game. Granted, it was a sweep, but it's probably a big part of the reason why he had the sweep. And, of course, Dan Dreesen was part of that as a designated hitter, the first DH in National League history. But if we come over here, there's a really interesting panel that highlights some of the amazing stats associated with this Grade 8 lineup, many of which take folks by surprise. But we always like to highlight this, that 87 games was the sum total that this group played together. The Grade 8 starting lineup only appeared in 87 games. And that is including the postseason, but their record in those 87 games was 69-18, meaning they won almost 80% of their games. That's an unheard of number. If you extrapolate that over a 162-game season, obviously taking some liberties, but if they kept winning at that 793 clip, they would have put together a record of 128-34 over a 162-game season. So a very well-respected baseball historian, we use his quote here, a guy by the name of Rob Nyer, who's written some wonderful books on baseball history. He had a great line where he was asking, somewhat rhetorically, was it the greatest starting lineup in history? And according to him, the line forms right with the Big Red Machine. So very, very special group, and one that we are unlikely to see the likes of again.
Chris, rattle off the names of the Grade 8.
The Grade 8, well, of course, we'll just run down the lineup. At third base, you had Pete Rose. At second base, Joe Morgan. Your catcher was Johnny Bench. Your first baseman was Tony Perez. Right there, you've got three National Baseball Hall of Famers and one who certainly would be, if not for some of the off-the-field issues. And then rounding it out, you've got George Foster in left field. Dave Concepcion was your shortstop. Ken Griffey in right field. Cesar Geronimo, your center fielder. And when you start looking at that group, you've got a National League MVP in George Foster. You've got multiple Gold Glove Awards with Concepcion and Geronimo. You have Ken Griffey, who was a multiple-time All-Star, came within a hair's breadth of winning the batting title in 1976. It's almost ridiculous when you start looking at all the accomplishments of these guys. And what was so special about them is that they played so well together. These would have been stars anywhere they played, basically. You know, even Joe Morgan. Joe Morgan was a very accomplished player before he came to Cincinnati when he was with Houston. But when he got here and was surrounded by this group, his play was elevated. He went from being an all-star second baseman to being arguably the greatest second baseman to ever play the game. So these guys worked really well together. Sparky was the guiding hand, and it was just an incredibly special team. Continuing to look around the exhibit a bit, we wanted to make sure that we highlighted the Reds pitching staff. Very often that group gets overlooked in the shadow of the Grade 8. Many folks think that if only they'd had better pitching, they would have won more. The fact of the matter is the Reds had very, very good pitching throughout the decade of the 70s. The biggest thing that held back their pitching staff was injuries. And two of the jerseys you see on display here, one belonging to Don Gullett and one belonging to Gary Nolan, those two players in many ways highlight some of the what-ifs of that team. These were guys, both of whom broke in as teenagers and both suffered arm injuries as relatively young players, which really shortened their careers. Gary Nolan missed almost two full seasons with an arm injury at a time during his career where he would have been at his peak. He did a wonderful job of kind of reinventing himself. He had been a hard-throwing pitcher. He came back. He couldn't throw with the same velocity, so he had to rely on finesse. He won 15 games in back-to-back seasons for the Reds in 75 and 76, and sadly his career ended shortly after that. But if Gullett and Nolan, just to use two examples, had been healthy throughout that decade, we would probably be talking about them as being National Baseball Hall of Famers as well. They were that good. Also in the exhibit, you'll see we've got gold gloves. We've got an example of one of Johnny Bench's gold gloves here. We've got one from Joe Morgan across the way. A reminder of how complete the team was. When you went up the middle with Bench as the catcher and Morgan at second and Concepcion at short and Geronimo in center, you had Gold Glovers everywhere. And that's pretty astonishing to have Gold Glove caliber defense all the way up the middle of your defense. And these weren't one-time winners. These guys won them multiple times. Bench won 10 straight. Again, some of the numbers kind of boggle the mind. That team was really a team without weakness. Bernie Stowe, the longtime clubhouse manager of the Reds, still with the organization, still down in the clubhouse every day. Bernie's career with the Reds, geez, goes back to the 1940s. His association with the club pretty remarkable to have one person be tied to the club for this long. But yeah, Bernie was a guy who took care of everything the players needed day in and day out. So if somebody had a last-minute need for a piece of equipment, or maybe even not a piece of equipment, it might have nothing to do with what was going on in the field, but Bernie was the guy they would talk to. And certainly these guys get together, and Bernie's in the room, and he is very much venerated by this group. Every Red who's ever basically come through Cincinnati will speak nothing but kind words about Bernie Stowe and how important a role he played and their level of comfort as players, and really their success as players. So Bernie's a real treasure, and we're very lucky that he's still with the club. And of course, the great Stowe tradition has continued. His son, Rick, is now the clubhouse manager, and his other son, Mark, is the visiting clubhouse manager. So we definitely have a Stowe legacy here with the Reds.
I'm Ken Griffey, and I am the Bakersfield Blaze manager in the California League. I first met Ted Kluszewski probably 1972. I was on the major league roster, 40-man roster, and he was the hitting coach for the Cincinnati Reds at the time. I knew of him because they always talked about this big guy with the cutoff sleeve and how far he hit the ball as a player and how big he was as a person, but he was still a gentleman. Well, Ted always believed in hitting off the tee, which I did a lot with him. And that kept me going all year, staying consistent, making good contact. And I never really got into as what people call a slump, because I never believed in a slump. If I'm hitting the ball, I got a chance to get a base hit somewhere. But Clu always kept us positive about how we approached the game, what we were thinking about at home plate. You got to be ready for situations, all situations. So he just kept us going. Kept us consistent, and he made sure that I always made good contact with Paul. Well, Junior met Clu when he was younger. I mean, he had to be 3, 4, 5 years old at that time, probably about 5 or 6 years old. He seen Clu a lot because the biggest thing for the kids at that time was father and son game, and they got a chance to go out on the field. So Clu was out there watching the games, and the kids were out there playing. Well, Ted had a great influence on the Big Red Machine. I'm talking about Ted was a guy like Johnny Bench, George Foster, Tony Perez, guy hit home runs all the time. So he made sure that those guys, like I said, were consistent. They never were in, as we call, slumps. They were always out battling. Clu always made sure that we were ready mentally about situations, what's going on the field, how to approach different pitchers, what they're going to throw you. He always kept us abreast of all that stuff. So Clu was just probably the mainstay. I mean, he really kept the Big Red Machine going, because he knew exactly what buttons to push in terms of all the hitters. And he'd work with Johnny Bench a different way than he'd work with George Foster or me or Pete Rose or somebody, or even Joe Morgan. I mean, that was just Clu's approach, was that he did not take one player and lump everybody into one situation. He approached them as individuals. I think that was the biggest thing about Clu. I remember when one time he pinned George Foster on the wall with one finger. This was during batting practice, and George wanted to do something else, and Ted pinned him up against the wall, and it was funny because George could not move. And we sat and laughed about that for a long time.
Noah Hunt is a Cincinnati native who's now touring and recording with the Kenny Wayne Shepherd Band. He recorded the song Under the Lights for the CD Cincinnati Clutch Hits, the proceeds of which supported the Reds Community Fund.
Just my dad and me, summer 1973. Rose was at the plate, here comes the first pitch, I can't wait. Standing on my seat, these Reds, they can't be beat. I was only 4 years old, so many stories yet to be told. Baseball was a boy's religion. I felt the power of tradition. I wish that game never would end, under the lights with my best friend. Times and the bad, still some of the best times we ever had. At the park or on the radio, long hot days with Marty and Joe. Baseball was a boy's religion. I felt the power of tradition. I wish that game never would end. Under the lights with my best friend. Springtime comes, summer goes, and in October one team steals the show. Till next season, we all wait. How many broken hearts, how many legends made? Just my dad and me, summer 1973. Baseball was a boy's religion. I felt the power of tradition. I wish that game never would end. Under the lights with my best friend. Baseball was a boy's religion. I felt the power of tradition. I wish that game never would end. Under the lights with my best friend. Under the lights with my best friend. Under the lights with my best friend.
Mark Haney stopped by the Price Hill Historical Society on Warsaw Avenue a couple of months ago for a tour of a baseball exhibition curated by Richard Jones.
What inspired you to make a baseball section in the museum?
I've been here for 7 years, and they had a lot of stuff stored away that people have given them that was baseball related. And I said, boy, it'd be nice if I could have an area for baseball. And they said, well, we don't have the area. We can't afford to do this. Well, over the years, we've accumulated a little bit of money, and we were able to air condition the second floor area. And they said, you can use this room. And they said, the work's all yours. You got to get the carpeting. You got to paint. You got to put the lighting in. It's all your project. We'll run the air conditioning into the room, but all the rest of it, it's yours. My wife was thrilled to death that some of this stuff was leaving our basement. Half of my stuff might be here, maybe. I've got a library of baseball books, and none of them are here yet. I've got a complete book of Elder baseball, a complete book of Western Hills baseball. They're not even up here. They're still downstairs. I wanted to put those on display so people could flip through and say, oh, there's my son in 1957. He was on that team. This is still a work in progress. I opened this up on opening day this year for members to come in and look around. I was here for 12 hours a day for the month before that, and I've been working on it off and on ever since then. There's a Price Hill Old Timers Baseball Association that every year elects somebody into their Hall of Fame. In the past, they've always been people who have played baseball in Price Hill. Now they've expanded it to the west side, and they've included Delhi Township, which is the Oak Hills District, and Westwood. And a number of these things I've got are copies of pictures of things that they have. But since I was in the newspaper and people found out that I was doing this, I mean, there isn't a day that we're open that I don't get a phone call from somebody saying, I have something from my dad, my grandfather, and they show me some picture and we sit and talk about baseball. And I just get tingly talking with other people my age and frequently older about baseball and the way they remember it. I mean, we could sit for hours talking about their knothole games. On Sunday morning, sometimes they go straight from church and they have their baseball uniform underneath the red of their clothes and they go straight from church to the baseball diamond and they have their baseball glove under the pew while they're sitting in church.
Tell us about this baseball glove.
We have a member, at least we did 22 years ago when we started business here, that found this glove and they said that it was my understanding, we don't have any of this written down. The only thing we have written down from them is a little piece of paper. They wrote this down, Harry Heilman, outfielder glove, 1930 model. And they said that Harry Heilman, when he played for the Reds in 1930 and 32, lived in their house. And that when they were cleaning things out, they found this glove. Well, it's a 1930s era glove. We know that from, I mean, taking it to any baseball collector, they can tell you that's a 1930 era's glove.
What other items do you have in the museum?
Uniforms. Wool flannel uniforms. Kids and adults wore these things when it was 99 degrees outside, and they played doubleheaders on Sundays sometimes. They sweated, and they didn't have air conditioning to jump into after the game was over. Hawk's Cafe is in Lower Price Hill. I know what the significance of that is. This is The Mason Lodge in Price Hill had their own team, was Lodge 524. One of our members gave us one of the shirts from their team. We think that's a Detroit Tigers D style, but we don't think this has anything to do with the Detroit Tigers because it was made by Spinney. Spinney as in Spinney Field. They were a manufacturer of sports uniforms, bats, baseballs. They were downtown, and they made this uniform. And my guess is it was either for Dayton, Kentucky, Delhi, some team that happened to have a D, and they liked the style of the Detroit's D, and they used that style D. Acme Glass. Yeah, Acme Glass was a sponsor of teams in the summertime. Boys that play knothole ball or high school ball during the school year, during the summer, they would be on a team that was sponsored by some business. There were a half dozen of them on this side of town that sponsored teams. Acme Glass was one of them. They played a lot of baseball, 2-3 games a week. They played for what they called national championships, even though they didn't go to Middle America or California to play them, but they called it the national championship because it was as far afield as they could go. I just happened to have a used uniform because before Western Hills High School came into existence in 28, the boys from Price Hill went to Hughes High School. That was the closest public high school, and that's where they went. And my dad was a Lower Price Hill resident, and that's where he went, was the Hughes High School. When all your pants only came down to your knees, which for the most part anymore, ball players are tripping over their pants. I mean, they're stepping on their pants for so long, but that's the way it is today. This is the way it was then. You had knickers, you wore stirrups with them. People keep giving us gloves. That's probably a 1960s era glove. This is just the kid's glove that probably not even leather.
Hutch.
But it's made by Hutch. And Hutch
I remember
is a,
that.
Hutchinson was down on 8th Street underneath the viaduct on 8th Street when it extended above the viaduct. But Hutchinson made gloves for 100 years, probably.
Who was Pat Moran?
Pat Moran was the manager of the Reds back in our 1919 World Series. Once again, as we say here, he lived on Grand Avenue. We've got crisscross directory proof that he lived there. I think he originally came from New York area. But when he managed the World Series Reds, that was their very first World Series that they were ever even in, Pat Moran lived in Price Hill. I mean, he's our most successful early manager.
Who was Andy Gallagher?
Well, he's our local legend. When they started the baseball old-timers, and then they called themselves originally the Dempsey Ballpark old-timers because most of them played at Dempsey Park, which is about half a mile down the road here. That was the first city park on this side of town in which they put a ball field. They drug the infield, they put in baselines, they had sunk a mound and a home plate where people could really play like they were big leaguers. There was a lot of lots where kids played ball. They would measure out the distances, and they might put somebody's hat at second base, and that's second base. But this was a real live park that had dimensions. If you hit the ball to the street on either side, it was going to be a home run. It was in a valley, and it seemed a natural place to have a ballpark. Mostly adults played games there because the adults took the park over, of my understanding, of people that played in the 20s and 30s. And when they got off work in the evening, Saturdays and Sundays, the adults took the field over, and the kids pretty much had to play on lot somewhere, which was called sandlot baseball for that reason. It wasn't always sand, it was usually clay. Dempsey was a good ballpark to play in. They had hillsides where you could sit people. They had a grandstands where you could sit. They were wooden at the time. When I was a kid, they were metal. Andy Gallagher was the legend there. From the time he was, I'm sure, a kid in grade school, he played ball there because he lived within a couple blocks of there. I don't know if he ever aspired to be a Major League Baseball player, but he never ever played at any higher level than what we call Sunday ball. They had something that was kind of semi-pro when they played on Sunday afternoons where there was indeed what they would bring in some paid players, typically a pitcher who might get paid a portion of the gate, if you will, and if they sold refreshments, they might get a portion of that. He would have been playing in the 20s and 30s. I mean, before the 20s, professional baseball was really the only thing that was played on anything that resembled a real live baseball diamond. It wasn't the 20s. The city of Cincinnati started building fields. They started buying land from homeowners who wanted to see their kids have a place to play. And that's pretty much happened in the 20s. I mean, knothole baseball started in this area, nowhere else in the country. Knothole ball started in northern Kentucky and in the Western Hills area in 1932. Before then, there was no organized ball for kids. There was also something they called Little League Baseball. Well, both of these are still played in this area. They compete for kids in the summertime. Little League teams now they can play a World Series. And they play it in Williamsport, Pennsylvania every year. They indeed have playoffs in which you have to win something like, and after the season's over, if you think you're good enough and then your district thinks you're good enough, they can send you to the next level and you might play another 20 games after your regular season to get to the finals in Williamsport. I don't know if a Price Hill team's ever made the national championship, but that's Little League ball. And they play that around the world. I mean, Japan has Little League. Knot Hole is kind of a local thing. I mean, there are other organizations that call themselves Knot Hole clubs because the expression Knot Hole, I mean, here's your Knot Hole on the wall. That's another Saturday Evening Post cover. That's why there is a Knot Hole baseball, because supposedly kids watched games through the Knot Hole in the outfield fence. But in Cincinnati, it was actually the Knot Hole baseball was an organized operation that adults put together so that their kids could have nice places to play, nice uniforms. They could get businessmen involved in sponsoring them because it was a real organization that had a letterhead, everything else. So it was easier to get money. That's Knot Hole. He played ball as a kid before there was Knot Hole ball even. But the fact that he continued playing every Sunday, he played ball. And what we were told by his kids, who are still alive in Price Hill area, he played until he was in his 70s. He was always a catcher, but he was obviously in pretty good shape.
Is baseball still alive in Price Hill?
Oh, yes. Cincinnati Public School System built a really nice field out at Western Hills High School. It's where all the Cincinnati Public Schools play their home games. It's called Pappy Knorr Field because Paul Knorr was the baseball coach there for a number of years and had a lot of success. The Cincinnati Steam is a local team. It's sponsored by a dentist here on the west side, and they play ball with wooden bats. It's just not the same game with something. When a baseball hits something other than wood, it pings instead of cracks. I mean, the crack of a bat is not the ping of a bat. But they've been playing now for 7 years, I believe, and they play in Price Hill, and there's always a Western Hills player on the team. Always. They're either from Western Hills High School, Oak Hills High School, Elder High School. There's always seems to be a boy from the Western Hills. The team is made up of college freshmen, sophomores, and juniors who either live in the Cincinnati area or play ball in the Cincinnati area with a college team. They have to be matriculated at a college in order to play on the team. Major League scouts come to the games. You can sit up in the upper part of the seating, and you'll always find a Major League scout there because they want to see if these kids who are hitting 400 in college with a non-wood bat, if they can still hit with a wooden bat. And if they can field, fielding is even different off because of whatever reason, I don't know the physics of it, but balls come off of a non-wood bat a lot harder and faster.
What are the hours of the Historical Museum, and what are your future plans for it?
We are open in our museum from 1 o'clock until 4 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We have a website, we have an email address, we have a phone. If people call, we send out 750 newsletters every single month. But this is an ongoing project for me. As long as I'm around, I'm going to continue doing this. I'm just thrilled to death to talk to anybody that has any history in baseball, or I mean about their experiences as kids or as adults. And I'm also writing a book, which I think might be called Cincinnati's Baseball on the West Side. It's going to be mostly about Knot Hole teams, high school teams. It's not going to be about just the guys that made the majors. I mean, the Pete Roses and Don Zimmers. It's going to be about kids playing ball and enjoying playing ball. I've been working on this book for about 7 years now. Any information I get from people, that's going to feed the book. And I'm not going to put a lot of people's names in the book because it's going to be about the experience of playing baseball, not about making a living doing it. It's going to be about having fun playing the game. And if you can make a living at it and have fun too, that's just fabulous. But we just want to see people continue playing the game and playing it the way it should be played. And that's with a wooden baseball bat, we feel. But
Well, Richard, thank you very much for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak with somebody who understands my joy of participating in the game and promoting it to other people. I hope people can enjoy this game forever.
I've been speaking with Richard Jones, curator of the baseball exhibition at the Price Hill Historical Society. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Mark Haney.
Reds Fest is coming up December 7th and 8th in downtown Cincinnati. Zach Bonkowski, Reds Director of Promotional Events, dropped by the studio to preview the event with Mark Haney.
How long have you been involved with Reds Fest?
This is my 8th year of running Reds Fest as a Reds employee.
When did Reds Fest start, and why did it get started?
It actually started in 1997 as an initiative of then-new ownership, Carl Lindner. They brought it together in 1997 to celebrate the coming of the new season, a way to get everything going leading into spring training as far as a way for fans to actually meet players. And it's grown since then, especially under the Castellini ownership, which their first year running Reds Fest was 2006. And it's really grown since 2006 into what it is today, which is what we believe to be the best individual team fan festival in all of Major League Baseball.
Well, how has it grown? Take that very early one in the 1990s compared to today.
If you measure it as far as attendance, our largest attendance prior to 2006 was around 11,000 fans over the 2 days. Last year, our attendance was over 23,000 for the 2 days, so it's doubled as far as attendance goes. The biggest single change, I would say, over the course of the two has been the amount of interactives we have for fans, and especially for kids. Whereas the old Reds Fest may have just been about collecting some autographs and getting some memorabilia, today's Reds Fest is much more about the experience, the chance to go and play on a miniature indoor field, the ability to meet players not only in autograph or photograph lines, but to have them read to your kids in the Reds Fest reading room, or to interact with them in Q&As, both on the main stage and with smaller booths off the stage.
And this is a very kid-friendly event, I take it?
Yes. Actually, I would say that Reds Fest, what strives to, again, adhere to the what Reds Fest has always been, which is a chance to meet players, a chance to collect one of your favorite autographs from some of your favorite players, both past, present, and, of course, future. And then, additionally, we want children to have a great time, to look forward to Reds Fest each year as something they do and they come to know. And it's actually the kickoff of our sales of our Reds Heads program, which is our club for kids. This is the start of the next season for kids, and the next season for our fans in general is Reds Fest each year.
For the uninitiated, somebody who's never been to a Reds Fest, walk us through it and describe what it's like when you first enter that door till the end of the day.
It starts with the introduction of players on Friday so that you know who is there, both past, present, and future players. And it continues throughout the weekend with music on the main stage, with question and answers with our players. We have an absolute ton of interactives, especially for kids. Batting cages, speed pitches, 2 indoor fields. We have a Reds Fest reading room. We have a large display from our Reds Hall of Fame and museum. And again, we have those opportunities to meet current and former Reds players. Each year we have around 60 current, former, and future Reds players who attend the event. We have up to 12 interactive autograph and photograph sessions going on each hour. So over 250 opportunities for folks to meet players past, present, and future throughout Reds Fest. And of course, it's capped off by what we do each year with our Reds Community Fund Celebrity Poker Tournament, which is just a really neat experience and really, really the only team in baseball that does something like that with our fans.
What's the draw on Reds Fest? Do you get people from around the country, or is it mainly just people from what would be considered Reds country who come to it? Or
I think for the most part, it's throughout Reds country. Again, because it takes place over a 2-day weekend in December, we find a lot of folks coming in from West Virginia or Indiana or Southern Kentucky, Tennessee, Northern Ohio, who spend the weekend in Cincinnati and make a weekend trip of it, who'll come down and see the festivities that are taking place on Fountain Square and around the area at local attractions, and will book in that around their trip to Reds Fest. And of course, we draw from the Cincinnati area very well in addition to that. Again, we can just look at the attendance numbers of Reds Fest, and it continues to grow each year, and it continues to have us strive to make it a better event for fans each and every year. This year in particular, we're going to really make sure that the entire facility, the Duke Energy Convention Center, is used to its fullest so that fans are interactive and engaged throughout the entire facility and not just on the main floor.
The proceeds from Reds Fest, what are they used for?
The proceeds from Reds Fest benefit the Reds Community Fund. The Reds Community Fund is engaged in our local community with a few general missions, one of which is to rebuild baseball fields throughout Reds country, not just in the Cincinnati market, but in Louisville and Lexington. And in addition to that, they run youth initiative baseball programs throughout the area for all kinds of kids. They have a general focus on those who may not be able to play baseball otherwise, but they also do some very progressive programs with our match program, which matches up a suburban team with an inner city team that might not otherwise get to know one another or get to play each other. And of course, the Reds Community Fund, one of their larger initiatives that they're undertaking right now is the development and the building of a Reds Urban Youth Academy, which will be a year-round facility that is open in Roselawn that will allow kids to play baseball not only in the summer months when the weather cooperates, but throughout the year so that we're really growing the game of baseball in the Cincinnati community.
How much of a financial impact does Reds Fest have on the Reds Community Fund?
Numbers-wise, we probably generate about $100,000 for the Reds Community Fund in profit each year from Reds Fest, which is a small fraction of what they need from an operating budget to, again, grow each year and get more kids playing baseball and rebuild more fields and, again, develop this Urban Youth Academy. So it's a small portion of what they do, but if nothing else, it gets the word out about the Reds Community Fund, which is something that we still try to do to this day, is to let people know that this nonprofit exists in the Cincinnati area and it's doing great things in our area. It's been around since 2002. Now it's entering its 10th year and beyond. It continues to grow and produce more fields for playing baseball and really be ingrained in our community as one of those charitable organizations that's really unique to the Cincinnati area.
Talk about this year's Reds Fest. What are the dates? Where is it going to be? Who are some of the people who are going to be there?
Reds Fest 2012 will be held Friday, December 7th and Saturday, December 8th at the Duke Energy Convention Center, downtown Cincinnati. The lineup, you can expect to see your current Cincinnati Reds players, as well as 10 to 12 minor league players who will be Reds of our future. I tell people, get to know these guys as they're coming up through the minor leagues. Players that are currently on our team that attended Reds Fest as minor leaguers include Zach Cozart, Drew Stubbs, Jay Bruce. These big names that are now a part of our team are the guys that originally came to Reds Fest when they were AA or AAA players. And of course, we bring in the Reds greats. We invite all of our Reds Hall of Famers, and they'll come in each year. And those are some of the great moments, seeing those Reds Hall of Famers, the Tom Brownings, the Eric Davises, see them interact with our current and future Reds is really one of the neat moments of Reds Fest each year.
Tie-ins with Reds Fest weekend and the Hall of Fame. How does the Hall of Fame fit in with that, and what kind of activities do they have for Reds Fest weekend?
The Reds organization is very proud of our Reds Hall of Fame Museum, which we believe to be the top Hall of Fame museum held by an individual team in all of Major League Baseball, and only the second best in all of America when you compare it to the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. So it's very important for us to bring elements of the Hall of Fame to Reds Fest each year and give them a large area at Reds Fest for fans who may have not been through our Reds Hall of Fame yet to see what it's all about, to embrace the history of the Reds organization. So in the Reds Hall of Fame area at Reds Fest, you can expect to see some very unique displays from the Reds Hall of Fame, which each year they change out their main display. So the 2013 main display, some parts of it will be on display at Reds Fest. We always bring over a World Series trophy so that fans can take a photo with the World Series trophy, which is always a very popular thing. And we also bring our Reds Hall of Famers and alumni into the Hall of Fame area for fans to participate in Q&A sessions with them, to get autographs, to get photographs. And it's just a really neat experience to see that history, that rich tradition of Reds history brought alive at Reds Fest in the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum area.
The Rosie Reds participation in Reds Fest.
Absolutely. The Rosie Reds, well, first of all, they're one of the top organizations in all of Major League Baseball in terms of supporting and rooting on a franchise, the oldest philanthropic organization throughout Major League Baseball in terms of supporting a singular franchise. At Reds Fest, we're honored to have the Rosie Reds with a booth at Reds Fest each year where fans can learn more about the organization and, of course, sign up to be a member. The Rosie Reds organization membership has grown, I think, under the Castellini ownership group, and it's something we embrace, and we'd love to help them out as much as possible and have them grow with us. And, of course, we do have the Rosie Red mascot, and we're happy that Rosie Red appears at the Rosie Reds booth each year so that fans can get to know her and, again, get to know this great organization, which does so much for our community, supporting our local athletes with scholarship presentations each year, and is a great philanthropic and, of course, Reds supporter organization that we embrace and we have a booth for at Reds Fest each year.
This has been an Around Cincinnati Baseball special. You'll find links to the Cincinnati Reds and other organizations featured at WVXU.org. You'll also find two web exclusives there, the 1956 Cincinnati Reds baseball team on the CBS television show What's My Line, and a short 1977 interview with Pete Rose talking about hitting advice he'd give if he was Ted Kluszewski. Technical assistance on this special from Kevin Rowinski and Bruce Ellis. I'm producer and host Lee Hay, with production assistance from Mark Haney. Next week, we'll celebrate Halloween. You'll hear about the Dead Celebrity Cookbook and an experimental Halloween film showing at the Downtown Public Library. Next Sunday from 7 to 8 on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.